I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University, mostly in Fremantle, but sometimes all around the world. Martin, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Michael.
Wouldn't you have loved to have been in the CNN studio in Atlanta, Georgia at 9 o'clock Frio time this morning to watch Biden and Trump handling the not-so-curly questions thrown at them by the CNN anchors, a man and a woman?
Yeah. I think if you were, you'd be the only member because there was no other audience. It was complete audience-free, and that was one of the changes. They had the mic that gets muted as well. Strangely enough, that probably helps Trump because if Trump just continued to shout over Biden like he did a couple of times before, I think that just confirms what people think. You don't like him. So it probably helped him in that respect. But it was a bit of a sterile environment accordingly.
Martin, you and I have seen a lot of, if not all of it. I got a big surprise. I watched it the whole way through. And my bar for each of them was extraordinarily low. Having watched Trump on television in these sort of election settings on a number of occasions over the last number of years, even going back to the time he was wanting to be pre-selected as a candidate for the Republicans when I was on Long Island on leave, I expected him to be bombastic, to be rude, to cut across people, although, as you've said, the format didn't enable that to happen. And then I expected for Joe Biden, given all of the publicity, that if he could make it out onto the stage and stand at the lectern without falling over, that people would say that was a great thing and he deserved re-election. And if he didn't stutter or slip over his words or forget them too often, then we didn't have too much to worry about. And applying those bars, Trump is actually, despite his usual histrionics, he wasn't too bombastic, he wasn't too rude. And after a pretty sloppy start, Joe Biden seemed to pick up and get his dander as he went along and became more articulate as the show proceeded. But what did you make of it all?
Oh, look, I thought Biden struggled. I think he only had one. His main thing that he had to convince people was that he had all these marbles about him, that he had the energy and clarity and he could articulate key points. He did struggle a little bit, particularly early. I think he gained a bit of momentum. He got a few punches in late. But the overall, you're talking about two aging boxers that are well past their prime. Can you imagine, someone, two guys sort of slugging it out in the ring and you're going, hey, I reckon I can do better than this. I mean, I think we might have touched on this theme before, Michael, but it's astounding to me that this is the best they could come up with. There's got to be a lot of bright, energetic, passionate, articulate, talented people across the US, many of whom could perform much better than those two guys on the stage did this morning.
You're absolutely right. In fact, at the very end, or close enough to it, they started debating golf handicaps. And it was Trump who started it because he made some reference to, as I recall it, Biden not being able to hit a drive 50 yards, to which Biden sort of responded and said he once played off a 6 handicap, which is all pretty nice. But it became this funny little niggling shouty match at the end. But there were amazing things, like towards the end, you have Trump saying that this is the man who will lead us into World War III. But, Biden will do it. And if you want to stop that happening, you better vote for me. Well, I was left cold.
Yeah, look, there were vastly different tones. Trump, everything in the US is going to shite, essentially, and criminals and immigration and all of these things that sort of chaos and out of control, which is a bit ironic coming from Trump, mind you. And Biden, attempting to be the steady hand, which he would do better if he was a steadier guy. And I think that's where he sort of struggles a little bit in that respect. But the bar for these guys now is really low. And so if all Biden needs to do is sound somewhat remotely coherent, then he passes, and all Trump has to do is not seem too unhinged. So we're not actually expecting much of these leaders, on the whole. I even think it, our debates that we have in Australia are better than this, where there's some meaningful discussion of policy. You just talked about how it descended into insults. It's not quite as bad as it was 4 years ago. The format might have helped, but still sort of descends into base insults. Yeah, look, I'm a bit cynical, but I also don't think it changes, barring disasters. It doesn't change as many votes as people think that it does. And we're still, it's not an election to November, so it's still a fair way out.
I, having seen this debate, thought, I hope they don't run anymore. I don't think I could be bothered watching the next one because it will get sillier. And I suspect the more debates, the better for Trump and certainly not for, for Biden. He sounded like a much older man when he started. He had this husky voice and he was speaking so fast. I'm sure his minders would have told him to try and slow down. But it was fascinating the topics they covered. They talked about inflation, they talked about tariffs. I mean, every time there was a question, Trump never answered it. He would just talk about all the migration criminals, and they're stealing everybody's jobs, and that's why we've got all of these problems in America. And they all keep coming across the border, and this man is going to cause World War III. It was just disaster and negativity, but fascinating towards the end. Martin, the question was put to Trump, will you accept the election result put to him by the woman anchor? He didn't answer it. He talked about Ukraine and that saddened him and all Biden's fault, apparently. So she went back and said yes or no. And his answer was, if it's fair and good and legal.
That's far from an unequivocal answer, isn't it? Now I'm glad you picked up on that because we just talked about how there wasn't that many takeaways from the debate, but I'm glad he got pinned on that. And if it's one thing that he should get pinned on, and I know he got asked about January the 6th too, which I was pleased about. Fundamentally, unless you can point to where those deficiencies are, and this is part of the problem for the Trump campaign. They lodged various lawsuits. They took this through the courts post the 2020 election, and they didn't get anything. They couldn't find any evidence that showed that the results actually should have been overturned in any of the states in which they challenged the result. So they have been unable to put up any evidence. Everyone's entitled to make allegations about an electoral system. Go for it. So there's nothing, there's not been any substance produced to back up this allegation. And when he's asked about it, he's equivocating again. And if we saw what we saw after the last election, it is a bit disconcerting, I think, to hear him say that.
I'm sure it is. Martin, let's, because we'll be talking about this topic for some time after the US elections, and I'm all sort of enervated by the whole thing again, but there's another election about to happen, and that's the UK general elections. They're sort of on us sooner than perhaps we, many of us, realised. Who's going to win and why?
I think we can be pretty confident about that. Labor's going to win in the UK, and they're going to win big. So this is a government that's been around in office a long time. They've gone through five different leaders. Now, we had Labor go through a couple, and then we had Liberals go through a few, and we were disgusted by that revolving door in both cases, I think. And this is worse, really. Five different prime ministers. One had lasted a couple of weeks. Look, it's been a bit of a basket case, and that seems to be universally agreed, even amongst conservatives in the UK, who are expecting themselves to get wiped out. And it's only a debate and a discussion about how big that wipeout's going to be. In fact, could it be so bad the conservatives are not even the main party of opposition? I think that's what the interest now lies in. The Liberal Democrats will do all right just as an alternative, but the other one to watch is the Reform Party of Nigel Farage. This is, Mr. Brexit, who never has actually had to answer for the patently awful outcomes of Brexit since it got up. But he's leading, the far right party against the Conservatives, and for the people who never want to vote Labour, he's definitely firming as a real option for them. This is going to be very, very interesting. It's going to be dog's breakfast on the right in terms of where those votes go. But I think we can be pretty confident about the overall result.
So, in short, what is it that the Tories have done wrong over these years, apart
Oh,
from?
how much time have you got? Let me just talk about Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson enforced a range of very severe lockdown measures. Now, that's okay. Mark McGowan did in Western Australia too, and was very popular for it. But he flouted his own lockdown measures, not once, but on multiple occasions, and lied about it. If there's one thing the public can't stand, it's hypocrisy. And this ended up finally being the undoing of him. But that his whole time as Prime Minister was chaotic and messy and crazy. He was a bit of a Trump-like figure, but in the UK, unlike the US, you do actually get pinned by the parliamentary committee process, where you have to front up and you have to answer for your actions. And clearly, he made an absolute mess of that. Liz Truss replaced him and was so bad that her own MPs told her to get out to a couple of weeks into the job. I think the only claim to fame that she could have is that she was the last prime minister sworn in by the Queen. In her dying days, she put up an economic package that was so crazy that her own MPs saw that it wouldn't work, and the stock market crashed. Well, maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit. It fell markedly because of this. Like I said, how much time do you have, Michael? I think many of the Conservatives are in open revolt under Rishi Sunak's leadership, and he's probably better than Boris and Liz Truss was, but it's not going to make any difference. There's a sense that they've been in power too long. There's a sense that the party's a mess and disunited. I think probably the seeds of their destruction were laid as far back as the Brexit referendum. They had Cameron come in on a massive wave of support. His cra most crazy decision was to hold that referendum. He was opposed to Brexit, but he thought it would fail, and he didn't campaign well on it. Labor was only half-hearted behind it because Jeremy Corbyn was only half-hearted behind it, then they struggled in particular to address that. Even Boris Johnson, who was an unabashed supporter of Brexit, couldn't really make Brexit work. I think the seeds were sown then.
And on top,
Like I said, how much time do you have?
and then on top of all of that, in the middle of the campaign, the current Prime Minister Rishi Sunak
Well, yes, the D-Day fiasco.
decides to leave.
Oh,
It's
who
not a
leads D-Day?
D-Day
Like, this is a
celebration, you know.
sacred event. It'd be like one of our prime ministers saying, "I'm not going to attend Anzac Day, and I'm going to go off and do a Women's Weekly." Sorry, don't mean to be sexist, but some magazine interview instead of, doesn't matter if it's Women's Weekly. It could be any old, half-baked media interview. Yeah. Anyway,
Going back to Boris Johnson, our listeners will appreciate the point you've been making. Can you imagine if Mark McGowan, during his sainthood period, had been discovered to be out partying in Bridgewater lockdown? I don't think he would have
But
run the next
that's the
election.
thing. I don't know how Boris Johnson could have possibly thought that that was okay in any realistic environment. But he's not a straight thinker.
Okay. Now there is a straight thinker on her standards in the federal parliament, namely Labor Senator Fatima Payman, who crossed the floor over the Palestinian and Gaza issues the other day. She was roasted, torched, you pick your word, by the Foreign Minister Penny Wong in the parliament. She was told or suggested to her she not turn up to the caucus meeting because she broken their rules, their solidarity. What do you make of it all, Martin? I mean, is crossing the floor not a good thing for party members to be able to do if it's a really important issue to them?
It does raise a very interesting issue about the Labor Party's internal rules. Very interesting. So, just to add some context for listeners, Labor Party is the party that's based off trade unionism. It's the political wing of the trade union movement. It was started by the trade union movement, and that movement has always valued solidarity and always emphasised collective political action. With that in mind, Labor MPs for many, many years have signed a pledge. A formal pledge that says that they will adhere to the decision of the party room, their caucus, and vote accordingly along party lines in the formal parliament. So that's the background and backdrop. The question is that still 100% the right path today? And I think Senator Payman's situation does should ask all of those questions because I can understand the outrage and the in Labor circles, given all of that context, if it was any old policy issue. But you're talking about someone, she is a Muslim woman in Parliament. She's the first, I believe, parliamentarian to wear a hijab in the National Parliament. Labor Party is prides itself on diversity. So they're talking that up. They have for some time. And here you've got this really severe reaction to her voting for a motion to support the Palestinian state. Now, we need to leave aside whether we think that that's a good or bad idea. Some people will agree, some people won't. But I think it's pretty tough ask to some ask someone like that, who comes from that community, and that's part of her identity, to then vote against that if it's something so close to home. And people bring up Penny Wong, and they talk about how she voted against or never supported same-sex marriage while the Labor Party didn't. And I would say that's actually demonstrates the problem. So how unfair was it for Penny Wong, and she should reflect on this, to have to not support something cl so close to home that's part of her identity because the party didn't support it. She should have been afforded that right, and so should Senator Payman. So I think there's an argument around conscience there that's not just about religious conscience, though it may be. I would expect anyone for their deeply held religious beliefs to be able to vote in line with those. And that's what the conscience vote's all about. I would expect things that are deeply aligned to identity, that some lenience is understood. And that's why I have some empathy for Senator Payman.
It seems that the other formal parties are a little more flexible about this. We have seen people crossing the floor. Do you think Labor will rethink its rules?
Well, I don't expect them to abandon it altogether because, like I said, the whole history and identity of the party is tied up in that. But perhaps a revisit of the rules to be a little bit more flexible when the issue that that MP is voting on is connected so closely to their personal identity. I would say this starts to feed into that concept of conscience that their MPs have enjoyed some freedom of in the past. So, if there was issues on abortion, euthanasia, stem cell research, all of those sorts of things, party MPs were given some leeway. Why? Because it's about deeply held personal beliefs, and we all have them. We're all entitled to them, and there needs to be some balance between loyalty to party and loyalty to yourself and your own beliefs there.
I suppose the ultimate contrast would be to take the Teals, the independent members of the federal parliament, and treat them as a party. But they go this way and that. In fact, Kate Chaney, the MP for Curtin in the federal parliament, just backflipped on her, it seemed, strong position against the live export trade with cattle, livestock, sheep in particular, and has just backflipped. And the suggestions in the newspaper, more commonly known as the Harvey Norman catalogue, is that she was worried about losing her seat because of all of the St. George's Terrace farmers in her electorate who have told her they don't like the ban on live exports. What do you think?
Well, firstly, I'll point out Teal movement's quite different to the Labor Party, and so I think they're naturally going to vote their own way. They've always emphasised their role as independents. But Kate Chaney, that is a really interesting one. because it's always framed as an electorate issue. I'm not sure, and I'm sure she was approached, absolutely, but I'm not sure. I think that's gonna win her or lose her that seat. So it is an interesting change of mind for her, very interesting, because I would say yes, there'd be odd person from an agrarian fa family or a farming family. There'd be people that empathise with the farmers in that industry, but you're talking about an fairly inner suburban area in the western suburbs of Perth. It's about as far removed from as WA can get from the wheat belt. So if that was the cause of her change of mind, then I think that she's not thinking that clearly, because I just don't think that that's going to be a huge electoral issue for her.
It's interesting, isn't it? She apparently, from what's reported in other media, saying that she's been listening to what people are saying and she's there to represent the people in her electorate. On the other hand, she might be said to have just quickly changed what was a very principled position. Well, we'll watch and see what happens. Now, someone who's had a very principled position for a long time and has spent one way or the other, a good dozen years locked up or confined for them is Julian Assange, who returned to Australia the other day, accompanied not only by a former prime minister, but also a former foreign affairs minister, Kevin Rudd and Stephen Smith, respectively. Our prime minister, Anthony Albanese, had a chat to him on the phone before he landed, for which he was later criticised. It's a beauty, isn't it, the Assange story? I mean, personally, I feel really sorry for anyone who was individually treated the way he was for what happened. And we put up a story on the Shipping News by Matthew Ricketson, an experienced journalist and academic in that field, pointing out why he's such a significant public figure. Has any of the return of Assange actually surprised you in the end, Martin?
I thought eventually it would come down to this, and there was noises, there was the odd hint behind the scenes that there would be some kind of deal. It happened very suddenly when it happened, and oh, okay. So yeah, it did sort of shock me a little bit at the speed of it, but I guess once the deal's done, the deal's done. But the other interesting thing here, Michael, is the role of Kevin Rudd and Stephen Smith, because they were actually mentioned in cables, particularly Rudd, that WikiLeaks mentioned. That they leaked. In fact, I think there was a bit of red faces with Kevin Rudd because he'd made some private comments to Hillary Clinton that during one of the meetings that came up in one of the WikiLeaks cables. So, and here he is as US ambassador, sort of lobbying behind the scenes for his release. So those two particular figures I thought was really curious because they were players at the time.
Well, Julian Assange is back here. We'll find out much more about his involvement, but one can understand the plea for letting him have a quiet time to go and have a swim each morning or each night as he likes and be with his children. There's various articles about what being confined in the way he has been, whether or not it was his own choice at times by going into the Ecuadorian embassy, does to your physical and mental health. As I say, I have a personal level, a lot of sympathy. It will be interesting to see if he wants to write books and talk about the role of journalism, whether or not he is a journalist. Would you be encouraging him to do something like that, Martin?
Oh, it's a bit of an interesting one, and it'll be interesting to see what his next steps are. Whether he sort of veers back into the public eye. There was a bit of a hint from his wife that he wanted to sort of lay low for a while. He wanted to sort of, live a normal life, so to speak. I'm not entirely sure what'll eventuate there, but I mean, certainly if he wrote a book about his experiences, particularly about the leaking of the material and how that came about, that would be, I'm sure that would make for interesting reading for a lot of people.
I think there's a movie in it. We'll wait and see. And I'm sure they, like all spouses, they want the other one to perhaps engage in quieter times. And on that note, Martin, I'll let you go back to the couch, and I'll just go and get my towel and swimmers and head down to South Beach. Sun's out in Rio today.
it's been a bit wild and windy here, but we can't complain. We haven't had much rain all year.
Martin, lovely talking to you as always. See you next week.
Pleasure.